This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Psalms. Today, Pastor Sandy will begin teaching in Psalms chapter 49 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
The next morning, when Hezekiah got up and he looked over the walls, all he saw was carnage and bloodshed and devastation. He couldn't believe it, that God had won this victory, that the troops had been slaughtered by an angel in the middle of the night. They had won the victory without even a fight. And that's when he picked up a pen, and either he or one of the sons of Korah wrote of God's deliverance. He says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The Hebrew word translated trouble means a tight spot. Ever been in a tight spot? I'll bet there are a few here tonight that are in a tight spot. I love Psalm 46. It's how to get out of a tight spot. That's another title for it. I love Psalm 46. Here's an outline for you. You can go back and really dwell on this psalm. It's a great psalm. One of my favorites. In verses 1 through 3, God is a refuge. God is a refuge. In verses 4 through 7, God is a river. And then in verses 8 through 11, God is the ruler. God is a refuge. He's a river. And He's the ruler. Now the psalm begins, God is our refuge. In other words, He's a place of protection from the storm. And life is full of storms, isn't it? Boy, life can flood us. A swirl of activity takes place. Situations overwhelm. Suddenly we're looking uphill. We were just bowled over. We didn't know what happened to us. Wow, how things can change so quickly. I've heard it put, life is like fighting a gorilla. You don't rest when you get tired. You rest when the gorilla gets tired. And yet God is a refuge. He is a very present help in times of trouble. That expression means He's easily accessible in times of trouble. Aren't you glad? Not a lot of red tape you have to go through to get to God. Not a lot of forms you got to fill out. Aren't you glad that when you pray, somebody on the other end of the line doesn't say, well, if you'd like Jesus, punch one. If you'd like the Holy Spirit, punch two. If you like God, punch two. Aren't you glad it doesn't work like that? That you can just come boldly to the throne of grace, cut through the red tape, just come immediately into God's presence. He is a very present help in trouble. He's our refuge. He's our rock. You know, my daughter was a cheerleader in high school. The best there ever was, by the way. And now she coaches cheerleaders. And she had a favorite cheer. We did it around the house all the time. I still know the words. Rain can't rock this house. Thunder can't rock this house. Lightning can't rock this house. And you can't rock this house. And my daughter was a cheerleader. I wasn't a cheerleader. I was the quarterback. But my daughter was the cheerleader. But this is what the psalmist is saying about God in Psalm 46. He's saying, bring on the storm, man. Bring on the rain. Bring on the thunder. It doesn't matter to me. You can't rock this house because my rock is Jesus Christ. My life is built on a solid rock. God is what we need when we need Him. You remember that when you get in a tight spot, okay? He says, therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed. And a literal translation would read, though the land changes hands. Recall the context here. Invaders are sitting just outside the city gates. And the psalmist is envisioning a worst-case scenario. He's saying, even if the city gets sacked, even if we're invaded and taken over by foreigners, God will still be faithful to His people. His plans for us will not fail. How's that for some real faith? He says, though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, though all this happens, I'm going to trust in God. Add to His list, though the economy tanks, though I lose my job, though I can't sell my home, though my teenager rebels, God is still my refuge. Who will I fear? You know, real faith, notice he says here, though the mountains be carried away, though the waters roar, though the mountains shake. Notice this, real faith is though faith. not if faith. It's not, I'll trust God if He makes my life easy, if He makes my life safe. It's not that at all. It's though faith, not if faith. It's, I'll trust God though hard times come, though difficulties arise. God is a refuge. And God is also a river. Verse 4. There is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. Now, in preparation of a siege against the capital city, King Hezekiah had moved to secure Jerusalem's water supply. The Gihon Spring bubbles up just southeast of the city. Do you see the little walls that jut out right there on the side? On the right, lower right-hand side? That's the Gihon Spring. Later, they built walls around it, but at the time, the water was outside the city, so they had to go outside the walls to get water to take it back into the city. Well, what Hezekiah did in preparation for this invasion, he went and he built a tunnel 1,777 feet long through this solid rock. This tunnel was an amazing feat of ancient engineering. It brought the water up into the city, so the water supply would be in the gates of the city, within the city walls. Therefore, they'd have access to the water in the event of an invasion. But it not only was it an engineering feat, this spring was also a picture of Judah's relationship with God. For like this spring brought water into the city, likewise God is a river who brings water into our lives. As the Gihon supplied Israel with water, God supplies us with supernatural strength and supernatural refreshment. Notice verse 5. He says, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. I love that verse. God is in the midst. Hey, God is always in the midst of whatever I'm in the middle of. Understand, God's right there with you. He's in the midst of your mess. He's in the midst of whatever you're in the middle of. God is not afraid to dive into our mess. I love John Phillips. He writes this. We see Jesus in the midst of the upper room after His resurrection, in the midst of the lampstands walking among the churches in Revelation. He is always in the midst. He says, where two or three are gathered together in My name, there I am in the midst of them. Isn't this the Christmas message? The world was stained by sin, but rather than God do away with the world, rather than God take us out of the world, instead He joins us in the midst of our muck and our mire. That's what Christmas is all about. He says, God shall help her just at the break of dawn. And in ancient times, armies always attacked at the break of dawn. In other words, at first light. But God was ready. He said, the nations rage, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered His voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Think about that. Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, had not counted on God being in the midst of the city. He saw this puny little city, thought, I could take that. He didn't consider God being in the midst of her. But here we're told, the Lord of hosts is with us. Recognize that? The Lord is with us. In Hebrew, that expression, God with us, is the Christmas title for Jesus. Emmanuel, God with us. In fact, it was Hezekiah's contemporary, the prophet Isaiah, who prophesied, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call His name Emmanuel, meaning God with us. Now, if you go back in Isaiah, and if you flip over a chapter from that prophecy, and if you read Isaiah 8, verse 8, the prophet predicts something else about Emmanuel. Not only will he be born of a virgin, but Emmanuel will spread out his wings, or his muscles, so to speak, and he will defeat the invaders. Go back and read it in Isaiah chapter 8. In fact, that's exactly what he did. Three times in the Old Testament, we're told that the angel of the Lord, that battle angel that I mentioned earlier, we're told that the angel of the Lord came at night and slaughtered 185,000 Assyrian troops. Hey, I believe that that angel or messenger of the Lord was none other than a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. Emmanuel, Isaiah called him. Who's that? That's Jesus. Here's what folks don't know about Christmas. The infant in the manger was really Hezekiah's deliverer. That's pretty mind-blowing. That little bitty baby was that battle angel who killed 185,000 Assyrians in one night. In other words, Mary's baby had been to battle. Now that blows your mind. That when Mary picked up that little infant, she was holding in her arms the warrior of God. Jesus had been here before, and he had won a great victory. He was going to win another victory, but this time through a different means. Verse 8, "Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. He is a refuge. He is a river. And he is a ruler." Our God rules over the nations. He rules over the troubles that we face. He says, "Be still and know that I am God." You know, fear grows in the noise of this world. Fear grows in the noise. If you listen to the noises, you'll become destined for confusion and fear. Skeptical friends and sensationalistic media and doubting voices, fear grows in those doubts. Only when we come to the quiet, only when we let God speak, that's the only time faith grows. Fear grows in the noise. Faith grows in the quiet. It's been said, the more we train ourselves to spend time with God and alone, the more we discover that God is with us at all times and in all places. He concludes the psalm, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." Now, Psalm 47 is probably a sequel to Psalm 46. It's interesting, though, that Psalm 47 was sung seven times in the Jewish synagogue prior to the blowing of the shofar on the Feast of Rosh Hashanah. The Feast of Rosh Hashanah, or the Feast of Trumpets, was the Jewish New Year. But for us, it foreshadows the rapture. My point is that in Jewish synagogue worship, this psalm was associated with the blowing of the trumpet. It could be associated with the rapture for us. Think about it in that context. He says, "Oh, clap your hands, all ye peoples. Shout to God with a voice of triumph. For the Lord Most High is awesome. He is a great king over all the earth." You know, when the Assyrian diplomat introduced Sennacherib to King Hezekiah, he called him the great king. It was an intimidating title. But notice here, the psalmist, he fires back. He calls the Hebrew God the great king over all the earth. Our king's greater than your king. "He will subdue the peoples under us and the nations under our feet." The New Testament says that one day when Jesus returns, he's going to put all things under his feet. "He will choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loves." And isn't that great? The word excellence literally means pride. In other words, these rebellious Jews, they were still God's pride and joy. He still loved them. It's amazing how gracious God truly is. He says, "God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God, sing praises. Sing praises to our King, sing praises. For God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with understanding. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people have gathered together, the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is greatly exalted." Now, Psalm 48 is a psalm of the sons of Korah. "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God in his holy mountain." Now God lays claim to two cities. His earthly capital is the city of Jerusalem. And his heavenly capital is heaven, or what we call the New Jerusalem. And the subject of Psalm 48 is actually concerns both the earthly and the heavenly Jerusalem. And he talks about the earthly Jerusalem. He says, beautiful in elevation. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, you know it's a fascinating place. Beautiful in elevation. Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. But what makes it even higher is the Dead Sea just below it, just south of it, sits 1,290 feet below sea level. This means that the city of Jerusalem towers 4,000 feet above the Jordan Valley. Jerusalem was built on five mountains. Mount Zion to the south, Mount Moriah right at its heart, Scopus to the north, Olivet to the east, and Ophel to the west. On the east of Jerusalem's walls, they rise even higher because they're rising up above the Kidron Valley. And it makes for the most magnificent skyline of any city on the earth. When you're standing on the Mount of Olives looking out over the city, it's amazing. He says, beautiful in elevation is this Jerusalem. He calls it the joy of the whole earth. And it was the lifelong ambition of every Jew to make a pilgrimage and see the holy city. It's the joy of the whole earth, he says. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. North of Zion was perhaps the most important of the mountains, Mount Moriah. This was the threshing floor that Solomon built the temple. Further north on that same mountain, just above where the temple was built, there was another hill. And this was the place where Abraham offered his son Isaac. And this was the place where later Jesus was crucified. It goes by another name, Calvary or Golgotha. The holiest sites were on the sides of the north. You know, it's interesting, that's true in all the ancient religions. The home of the gods was always located in the north. This probably stems back from the true throne of God in heaven. It's interesting, Isaiah 14 verse 13 says that when Lucifer tried to rebel against God, he exalted himself to the sides of the north. Again, God's throne is always on the sides of the north. Job 37 verse 22, another psalm, 75 verse 6, refer to God as residing in the north. The Bible indicates that heaven may somehow be in the north. God is in his palaces, we're told. He is known as a refuge. Jerusalem was invincible, not because of its elevation or because of its walls, but because God resided there. It was his city. He says, for behold, the kings assembled. They passed by together. They saw it, and so they marveled. They were troubled. They hastened away. Fear took hold of them there in pain, as of a woman in birth pangs, as when you break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish it forever. We have thought, O God, on your loving kindness in the midst of your temple. According to your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of your judgments. Walk about Zion and go all around her. Last December on our trip to Jerusalem, we literally obeyed verse 12. We went on a walkabout. We went on a walkabout Jerusalem. Actually, what we did is we went and we walked on top of the walls. We went up. We walked all around the top of the walls of Jerusalem. Did you know we were actually obeying God's word when we did that? Because here we're told, walk about Zion. Go all around her. You know, see the beauty, the city of God. It's precious to his heart. He says, count her towers. Mark well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. For this is God, our God forever and ever. He will be our God even to death. God in heaven loves people in every city on earth, but he has a special love for the city of Jerusalem. Well, Psalm 49 is similar to Psalm 37, if you remember it. It seeks to answer the question, how should the righteous react when we see the wicked prosper? An age-old question. Verse 1 tells us, hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and rich, low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will disclose my dark sayings on the harp. Why should I fear in the days of evil when the iniquity at my heels surrounds me? You ever heard that expression? They're nipping at my heels. That's where we get it, right there. Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother nor give to God a ransom for him. In other words, money buys a lot of stuff, but no amount of money in the world can purchase God's forgiveness. Hope you realize there's no government bailout for sin. Forgiveness is never for sale. Verse 8, for the redemption of their souls is costly, and it shall cease forever, that he should continue to live eternally and not see the pit. You know, in the Middle Ages, a corrupt Catholic church sold indulgences. In other words, for a price, you could get a get-out-of-hell-free card. It's basically what an indulgence was. I once had a drunk guy. He offered me money, and I knew what he was doing. He was trying to, you know, massage his guilt. You know, he thought by giving me money or giving the church money, you know, he could buy his forgiveness. I refused to take it. If he'd been sober and wanted to give me money, I probably would have taken it. But no, I'm just kidding. God doesn't want our money. God wants us. That's what he wants. And you can't buy forgiveness. You can't buy God's favor. As we talked about this morning, it's a free gift. You have to humble your heart and accept it, receive it. He says, for he sees wise men die, likewise the fool and the senseless person perish, and leave their wealth to others. Oh boy, money won't buy a second of life either, will it? He says, their inner thought is that their houses will last forever, their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Nevertheless, man, though in honor, does not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. A man names a ranch or an estate after himself. It bears his name for generations, but he goes the way of all men. I would suggest it's better to have your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life than on some ranch or some deed somewhere. This is the way of those who are foolish and of their posterity who approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. In other words, a rich man's body rots and deteriorates just like an animal's corpse. No distinction there. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall be consumed in the grave, far from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. See, he teaches a resurrection. He believes in the resurrection. For he shall receive me. Do not be afraid when one becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dies, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. You know, you don't go into the afterlife carrying a couple of suitcases. You don't take it with you. You've heard the old saying, you've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. You can give it away, and God will receive it. You can invest spiritually, and it will reap an eternal reward. Verse 18, though while he lives, he blesses himself, for men will praise you when you do well for yourself. In other words, you'll be praised on earth, yet he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see light. A man who is in honor, yet does not understand, is like the beasts that perish.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. As he continues in the book of Psalms, Pastor Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia, where he brings you messages from the Bible, book by book and verse by verse. We know that life can be challenging. That's why we want you to know that you don't have to go through it alone. If you have questions about Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, or if you're in need of prayer, please call us. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. We would love to hear from you. The psalmists, as they are called, wrote and cataloged this book with the hopes that it would encourage future readers to continue in a life of praise and worship to God. I bet they never imagined the impact it would have on this growing genre of music today. To learn more about this ministry, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. We invite you to join us this Sunday. We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. More details can be found online at sandyadams.org. Well, that's all the time we have for today, but we'll catch up with you next time on sandyadams.org.